Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Peter Carey, whose latest novel is Parrot and Olivier in America. Earlier novels include His Illegal Self, My Life is a Fake, True History of the Kelly Gang, Jack Mags, 14 books in all, two-time Booker Prize winner. This latest novel is a retelling of the story of Alexis de Tocqueville, very fictionalized. And I understand that what brought you to the story, long before you were thinking of writing it, is you kept hearing people quoting Tocqueville.
There were two stages, I think, in listening to it. The first thing is that I understand that he's this French aristocrat who came to the United States and really got democracy and really got America away and wrote about it. So that's the first level of understanding that I have. Then the second one was I guess I must have read an essay or I must have read more extended quotes, still not reading the book, and I started to sniff this other aspect of Tocqueville's comments, which were much more critical. The thing that I didn't understand then, which took me 2 years to understand, is that, you know, most of my friends, you know, my New York friends who are American and have been educated here, they'd studied Tocqueville, but they'd studied it like kids study things at college and school. They'd read the good bits. You know, they'd read extracts. And few of them had actually read the whole book. And so there's a sort of a rather distorted notion of what Tocqueville had said and what Tocqueville had understood, it seemed to me. But it took me a long time to realize that. And then finally, really sniffing this other sort of more critical Tocqueville, who was maybe a little bit more prescient, I thought, this is interesting, I'll read Democracy in America. So I got this rather intimidating book, 2 inches thick or something. But, I mean, it's beautifully written, although the translations from the English into the French and back into the... From the French, Tocqueville understanding the English, writing it in French, and that being translated back into English, sometimes gets a rather gorgeous but really sort of false manufactured tone to it. It's beautiful to read.
To give people an idea, a lot of people don't know who de Tocqueville was.
Of course, I never did either.
So okay, so...
I'm with the majority on this. Well, he was a French aristocrat. He was the child of parents who'd survived the trauma of the terror. His grandfather had been guillotined. His mother and father were on the brink of having their heads chopped off when Robespierre himself, the leader of the head chopping, was carried away and guillotined. So he, the historical character, and certainly my fictional character, Olivier de Gaumont, entered a sort of a world of trauma and loss. And the sort of age is one in which democracy seems imminent. The monarchists, the royalists, are doing their damnedest to turn back the clock. And the young Tocqueville and his friend, and my imaginary, Olivier de Gaumont, understands that democracy is unstoppable. Not to confuse things, he's spirited away to the United States, really, because his mother wants him out of a precipitous sort of situation. But really, his intelligence tells him that democracy is unstoppable. He doesn't really love it very much, but he's there to sort of see what he can learn from the United States that might apply to France. And he is a serious person and a very smart person and a publicly minded person who expects and wants a sort of a place in history. What can an aristocrat do in this new world? And the one thing that I was reminded of, and I was not born in this country, so maybe for people who are born in this country it's different, but I was reminded forcibly of the incredibly radical nature of American democracy. There had not been anything like this before. And in this imperial phase of American history, you know, we sort of, well, I anyway, had lost sight of that.
Peter Carey, two areas to go into. One is your writing of the book, and the other is comparing Tocqueville to Olivier. So, quick question. You have Olivier coming to the United States, Olivier de Gaumont, coming to the United States because his mother wants to spirit him out of France, and he's supposed to write about prisons. Is that the same thing that happened with de Tocqueville?
Tocqueville certainly came to the United States to study prisons. The government of France had very little interest in him doing it, and they would only agree to him doing it if the family paid for his expenses, and he was to write a report. And I think there is every reason historically to believe, and I wouldn't be radical in saying this, that the family, it was a polite way to get him out of the country at a time of political disruption in France.
And the political disruption goes from the revolution to Bonaparte to a republic to Bonaparte to a restoration and so on and so forth. And what's clear in your book is that it's never clear which side you should be on at any given moment.
Yes, or how even how your principles stand will pay off for you with death or promotion. Yes, absolutely. In any case, my fictional character, the historical character, leave for that reason. I think that's reasonable. I don't think a lot of historians are going to sort of argue about that if it's Tocqueville. But, of course, it's not Tocqueville. It's de Gaumont.
Which brings me to two of my next questions. First of which is, okay, you finish His Illegal Self. Is Tocqueville in the back of your mind at that point? What makes Peter Carey tick in terms of finding that next subject?
Richard, I really, really don't remember. I should remember and how it worked in relationship to the previous book. But I think by the time I'd finished the last book, I must have been starting to think about this. What Tocqueville gave me, what democracy in America gave me, this person who's now an American citizen and an Australian citizen, I hasten to add, who's lived in New York for 20 years, has American kids, and is passionately and fearfully often and angrily involved in the politics, you know, of my time and my place. So Tocqueville gave me a way to engage with what was happening now. So when I read something always that's sort of in the past where I can see the future very clearly, then I'm really excited because, I mean, that's really, after all, that's what history is. Yeah.
Well, at what point did you read Tocqueville? After you finished that book then? Or
it would have been afterwards.
Okay.
You know, I mean, where I thought there is a scary chance that there is a book in this and I'm going to have to invent a French aristocrat. And I bought the book, and as always in my weird sort of ADD sort of way, I pick up a pen and I'm underlining all of the things. And so I made a mess of democracy in America with millions of annotations and continued to find really, really thrilling comments about the United States made by this man in 1831. See, there am I sitting there in Lower Manhattan, and I'm really worried daily, as I'm sure you are and many of us who listen to this program are, by the fact that we're swimming in a sea of cultural crap. And then you read Tocqueville, this aristocrat who you're not really inclined to like, who's frightened of the tyranny of the majority and so on. And he's frightened of exactly the same thing, but so much earlier. And then, you know, I'm sort of critical of him because, you know, for somebody to be fearful of the rule of the majority sounds to me very reactionary. I'm an Australian, for God's sake. You know, we're descended from the convict seed and the convict stain. We are the majority. We're the success of the people, we feel. So he's suspicious of the rule of the majority. And when I slowly understand, you know, he's not worried that anyone can be president. He's worried that anyone can be president. And, you know, I'm writing this in the Bush-Cheney era, which is a very, we've lived through a scary time. And it's not as if the scary times are over, but maybe we've got almost a reprieve, I'm not sure. Then you're looking at that and that mess, and then suddenly you realize that Tocqueville was frightened of Sarah Palin. And it's there. I mean, it's in Democracy, maybe you can see him fearing exactly that figure. And so isn't that interesting, I think?
There's a point late in the book where he specifically comments about what could happen in America, the outcome, the lack of education could put forward someone, and of course he doesn't name him. And I figured, okay, Peter Carey is throwing this in here. And then in an interview I read, you said when you moved in that direction with Olivier de Gaumont, you were quoting Tocqueville.
And the bit in the end is not a quotation. That bit's not a quotation of Tocqueville. But there are many, many, many occasions in the book. In fact, if you find Olivier, and he is, very sort of quite snobbishly critical, which many people think I've made up, you know, that of course Tocqueville was not a snob. Well, he was. Of course
he was
a snob.
Aristocrat.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is going to say those things. So in this argument that is the book, with Parrot, who really is going to live the American dream, and Olivier, who's going to question it, anytime you find Olivier saying something vile about America, it's almost always lifted straight out of Tocqueville.
There's one point where he says that we aristocrats have the time to have refinement in art, and when it's all commercial, that refinement will disappear. Is that Tocqueville?
Yes.
Really?
Absolutely.
Peter Carey, you've written fictionalized history before, True History of the Kelly Gang. When you're going into a book like this, are you pretty comfortable with just taking off in your own direction, or is that still that thing in the back of your mind going, how far can I go?
No, it's always really clear what I want to mess with. I mean, the first thing is I really want to get the playing field right. I want to get the date of the history as we know it, to use a sort of a really ugly expression like macro history, the history of the world and when things happened and when there was a revolution and so on. And I want Andrew Jackson's going to be the president because he was, and all these sort of things I want to have right. I want the manners of the time to be right. I want everything to be right. Then I want to find a way to inhabit and invent my characters. Well, one of them's completely made up, but the Olivier one, it starts off being Tocqueville. But then I do things to make it really clear to the minority of readers, and they're probably a very small minority of readers who know a lot about the life of Tocqueville, that I'm messing with it. So to give you an example, Tocqueville came to America with his friend Beaumont. And actually the pair of them really wrote the book. The pair of them had arguments and conversations on and on, night after night, day after day, about the nature of American democracy. So the minute you don't have Beaumont, in a way, you don't have the real Tocqueville. So what I have a character called Blackville, who's his friend, who occupies the sort of place that Beaumont would. But I kill him off before they leave France. And the minute I've done that, to anybody who's worried about the history, you know, I've departed, I've taken off. And the minute I introduce the notion of a friendship with a person who's basically a servant, I've certainly entered the realms of fiction, because this is not only did not happen, but is a really unlikely thing. And as Parrott himself, I think, says, there has never been a friendship of this type in the history of the world ever before, you know. And it's an odd friendship. You know, Parrott referring to Olivier as Lord Migraine and Lord Pintledy Pantledy and various other, yeah, continual sort of storming, I think often quite comic, rage with his... He didn't ever think. He thought he was going to be an artist. And of course he is in a way. But to end up and to realize here he is in a democracy and his only real use in the world at this crisis point in his life is that he's a servant.
Which came first, killing off Beaumont or inventing Parrott?
Well, the minute that you... I don't know how rational I was about it, but I mean, the minute you introduce a new companion, there's no room for the old one.
And, of course, by introducing one, you create a lower-class character. So from the beginning, you have the democracy versus aristocracy battle going from the moment you start the book.
Absolutely, because Parrott's father is an itinerant printer. The English printers are very politically savvy, or they have opinions, and they might be socialists, and they're likely to be on the left, and they talk and they talk and they talk. So he is raised in a way to be sort of agin the government, as they would say.
You alternate their voices. How difficult was it for you, and were you trying, in the case of Olivier, to maintain a sense of the book that you'd read, whereas Parrott, you could go in whatever direction you want?
Olivier's voice, I don't know, it just sort of had to be an educated voice. It had to be sort of neurotic and a little irritable. It came to me, it's as invented as Parrott's voice. I made no attempt for it to sound particularly French. The voice is really to do with class, I think.
Okay, now you've got your book and you start your research, and there's a tremendous amount, because you want to put us in that time and place, 1830, France, America, mostly New York. I didn't get this, but apparently there was one reviewer who did, who noticed that there's another character who buys a house that she can't afford with mortgages that she can't pay, and that reviewer said, we're looking at the entire subprime story. When you were writing that segment, was that in your mind at all?
In fact, it wasn't. I was driven there by the needs of my character. I was thinking, how is Mathilde, this young French woman, going to get money? I needed to have money. And then I decided, well, she's going to get money by burning down houses that she's bought. And so I went into insurance and how a single woman can buy a house and how the insurance would have worked and why she has to do it under another name the second time and so on. And then I looked at the banker why would anyone lend her money? And so I sort of invented the reason for the character of the banker to lend her the money. But of course, as it happens, it does absolutely replicate the
subprime
mortgage crisis. But there were many other sort of financial aspects the book, you know, things that were very like the present time. I mean, something that, and this just comes out of history, you know, the time that Andrew Jackson sort of battling with the First Bank of the United States, which is using conservative, using the people's money, Jackson would say, to fight against the government. That sort of battle between bank and government, you know, did seem to have some resonance, certainly.
You're listening to an interview with Peter Carey, whose latest novel is Parrot and Olivier in America. Well, there are all these little bits and pieces through the story. At one point, we meet a couple of young entrepreneurs who have bought a whole bunch of pigeons, and they can't get rid of the pigeons. So they strangle all of these carrier pigeons. And stories like that seem imaginary, but was it or did
it? No, I just made it up.
Okay.
But I loved the notion. I forget why they were doing that at that time. But I think the reason they had the carrier pigeons was to make money on the stock market, because if you could get the money off the ships in New York, which it came from London, there was a stock exchange in Philadelphia. So if you can get the information to Philadelphia, you can make a killing. That's what the pigeons were there for. So the business of using that sort of information and getting it to Philadelphia is something that actually happened. But I don't know about carrier pigeons. And these two lads were their own particular trip, you know.
Somewhere toward the end of the book, and I'm not giving anything away, there's a kind of nod to James Audubon. How did you bring that into the story?
Well, when I began the story, there were a number of things that I thought might happen. I thought that Parrot would become an artist. One of the sort of tragedies of his life, or the crises of his life is better, is for the moment when he realizes that he's not going to be, although he clearly had talent. And I introduced a character who would first teach him about engraving. And I had him declare that he was going to do this book of, I think, I don't know, it wasn't then the Birds of the United States, it was the Birds of England, I think. Audubon would have been sort of at the back of my mind as somebody who would do that sort of thing. But at that stage when I'm inventing him, I don't really know what I'm going to do with the long arc of the story, and I don't understand what's going to happen to Parrot, and I don't understand that he, Watkins, the engraver, is going to be in America, and indeed is going to do in America what he wanted to do in England. So once I've got to that, well, of course I'm going to think about Audubon, because he actually did that. And the reason I'm going to think about Audubon is when I get into the business of producing these glorious prints and selling them in Europe, Audubon was just such a great source of information because he, in fact, did this. He sold them in Europe. He sold them in England. I don't know whether he sold them in France, but he certainly sold them in England. And there's certainly a great deal of correspondence about subscription and who's bought subscriptions and how to pack them and how to send them. So I was certainly indebted to Audubon and the New York Public Library, who actually found me the stuff. And I use that with great pleasure.
There's also a mysterious character, one nom Monsieur, the Marquis de Tilbeau, the benefactor. And, of course, I kept thinking, you know, Jack Maggs. Mm. Is that based on anybody or is that fictional?
No, he's totally fictional. And the weird thing, you know, like a couple of people have sort of thought of the relationship between Parrot and the Marquis as being rather like Pip and Magwitch, you know. It just didn't occur to me.
Really?
But it's so obvious. I mean, it's glaringly obvious, you know, so I'm not saying it had nothing to do with anything. I'm just saying I did this thing not thinking that could ring like that. And, of course, that's true. I mean, it's a perfectly clear reading.
Peter Carey, there's a story that you tell about going to de Tocqueville's chateau and having a historian map it out for you and then taking that map and creating the fictional Chateau de Garmont.
It was weirder than that.
Was it?
Well, I never went to the chateau. I was in New York, and a friend of mine, who's French, in New York, put me in touch with the architectural historian, who didn't speak very good English, and I wrote to him, and I said, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to mess with the history. Can you? And he found the chateau, which was a convent, and so it'd never been opened to the public for rich, rich, good girls, and he got in there, he did these glorious maps, which really revealed the structure of the chateau, how it worked. In a way, you sort of begin to understand it as a social machine or part of a broader society, and you see. So for me, my problem was, I know that if I'd been there, if I'd actually gone to the chateau, I'd still be like looking at some sort of monument. And he did take photographs, and I was not at all interested in the photograph. But What I was interested in was how he explained how the thing worked. It was thrilling. And I keep worrying about him because it'll be out in French soon and it'll be all translated. And he'll see that all the mad amount of work he did for me, which I was so continually grateful for, has in a funny way been sort of destroyed because I learnt enough from doing all that work to make my own place because I didn't want a chateau for Tocqueville. I wanted one for Olivier de Gaumont. I had no desire to go there. That wouldn't have been any use for me because the physical presence would have just pushed the truth away from me. And this way of doing it was great. In the research, you see, I find that there's a pigeon loft. And we were talking about the young men strangling pigeons in Europe. That would never have happened if there had not been a pigeon loft at the Tocqueville Chateau. And the peasants, you know, hated the pigeons, which the aristocrats kept for hunting, because the pigeons used to eat the seed. And so there's a whole bit of the story, which is really to do with the trial and execution of the pigeons by the peasants, discovered years later. So I suppose it's not so much the attitude towards it, but the story is really produced by the richness of the things that you find in your research.
When you're writing any of these novels, and you know that there are themes, do you try to just put them out of your mind and let your unconscious do its business? How do those themes intertwine with the actual writing?
I think you've really got to do both things at once. I mean, I think you've got to let yourself be sort of stupid and intuitive in a way, and let yourself follow things that you don't really quite understand. At the same time, I think you've got to be really aware of the road that you're driving on or that you wish to drive on, and although you can allow your discoveries and should allow your discoveries to let you take a different route, I think one has to be aware of theme and argument, but always being prepared to change your mind or even to change your argument if you discover something you just didn't know and it seems truer.
Is it easier or harder because, in a way, there's a kind of vague map pre-existing as compared to a book like His Illegal Self or My Life is a Fake?
No, not really. There are some books that are certainly more discovered in the process, and I would say His Illegal Self was more discovered in the early writing, but that would be to downplay the level of discovery that takes place in Parrot and Olivier, which is sort of immense. I mean, I can't believe I wrote it. The argument I would want to make is that it's no different, and then I keep on thinking of reasons to contradict myself.
Did Tocqueville plan on staying in America as Olivier kind of thinks about doing?
No. The thing that's really being dramatized in that, what is a sort of a romantic, we know nothing about Tocqueville's romantic involvements in the United States. And there's a little thing in the front which he wrote to his father, which he says sometimes it is better not to tell the truth. So we do know that he was a rather active young gentleman in many, many respects, romantically. So we don't know what happened. In my story, he does fall in love with someone, and that becomes entangled with his love for America. But Tocqueville, the thing that Tocqueville really loved about the United States, the thing that where he saw democracy in a way that was, for him, was ideal, was in the small towns of New England governing themselves. For him, that was just perfect, and the central government seemed not to exist, really. And for him, for Tocqueville, that was really what democracy should be, without any interfering centralized power. He was more class conscious about this sort of democracy, but in my book it's tangled with other matters, romantic, sexual, and so on.
Do you hit any snags in terms of how someone like Tocqueville or Olivier would relate to black people, for example, or is that in the book?
I think, you know, if you're going to write about a period, you know, how can you possibly write about the United States without dealing with slavery? Well, I couldn't do it. So one has to just sort of, I mean, because the subject is so huge. And in fact, Beaumont wrote a novel called Marie about slavery. You know, Tocqueville thought it was the great blot on the United States and it made a sort of a lie of the founding fathers and, you know, Constitution. But somebody like Obama, black and white, could not exist in Tocqueville's world. You would say in matters of racial politics, he was at least, the very least, liberal. So in my book, the issue of slavery, which is a central issue in the history of the United States, couldn't be a central issue in this. I mean, it's just I couldn't deal with it. It would be an unwieldy animal. But I had to acknowledge it because it's a central truth. So it is acknowledged, and There's a terrible line in there, which actually is lifted, I think, maybe from Beaumont or from Tocqueville, where there's an African-American waiter and either Beaumont or Tocqueville says, who knows, you know, what he thinks. What does a Negro think? It reads so shockingly. And I gave that to Tocqueville so that we sort of acknowledged that aspect of their lives and class.
Did Tocqueville take the tour that Olivier takes down to the South with the little cameo by President Jackson?
Tocqueville's travels were much more extensive than Olivier's. He certainly called on Andrew Jackson and was really shocked to find that the president of this great, the head of state of this great new democracy was a man sitting in a house by himself and was not attended with any of the, you know, pomp of state and anything that, you know, Olivier might reasonably expect. So I don't think he warmed to Jackson.
As you're writing the book, Obama did get elected. Did any, on some unconscious level, you think any of the hope that, the audacity of hope that we began to feel as the Bush administration drew to its end, did you think any of that got in there in the book?
No, actually. I mean, on the one hand, I'm writing my book because that's like a train on rails by then. I finished it round about that time. We had excessive hopes, I suppose. And I feel I have been rather naive in such was my desire to believe. But on that night when we were all crying and so couldn't believe that this had actually happened, in the middle of all of this, the greater good, the nation, the world, I suddenly turned to my wife and said, what does this do to my book? It's disgusting, right? She said, don't worry. Which she meant in two ways, artistically and politically. She meant, don't worry.
At one point, Parrott, whose real name is Larratt, he winds up in the tombs. Did you go to the tombs?
No. Dickens went to the tomb. So there's a little bit of that. Actually, one of the great bits of good luck, in a way, is that Tocqueville did visit the Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, and so did Dickens. The sort of two points of view that you get about exactly the same sort of thing were very helpful and very informative to me in thinking about Parrott's response to these prisoners and Olivier's response to the prisoners, because Tocqueville really did think that it was quite efficient and the ventilation thing worked very well, and Dickens saw the true horrible existential horror of these prisoners confined, not knowing who was next door, where they were on earth, or where were, you know, just working. The interesting thing, which I think maybe is in danger of sort of sounding either stupid or arrogant, is that in visiting the past, to visit the physical places as they exist now, I've found to be not very helpful to me. It's better to know them through reading and looking at the signs they have left on printed in print or in illustrations, and one gets free of the cloud that the present sort of puts over the things that have been left by the past. So actually in Philadelphia the other night, the woman who was driving me around events, as I've met many times and like very much, she said, did you go to the Eastern State Penitentiary? And I said, no, I didn't. And she said, well, it's just there. Just there. Do you want to see it? And I said, no. And she got so angry. Of course, she said, couldn't you just have a little bit of curiosity? Just a little bit of... And I said, well, you don't understand, you know, because the way that's got to exist for me is going to exist in the imagination. And actually seeing it won't tell me anything, particularly now that I've got a bad back and I want to go back to the hotel.
One thing that you couldn't duplicate would be what life was like on the ship coming over, which... You know, we tend to forget how distant France and America were.
Yes.
I don't think even seeing a ship, and I've seen those ships, we've all done that, really gives an idea of what life was like for anyone, whether it be Benjamin Franklin or Tocqueville or Olivier de Gaumont, crossing the Atlantic.
Yes, it's difficult. It's very difficult to imagine. I did so much work, you know, on shipping manifests and... You know, the actual ship that Tocqueville came on, and endless, stupid, sort of non-productive work in the end. And reading, I hope it works, but it was a lot of work to get there. And in the end, basically, it's imagination that makes it work.
But you have to have it in there anyway. I mean, you have to take all of this material and it goes into your brain and somewhere into your unconscious, and then what comes out is going to come out.
Yes. I suppose I think it was the thing that was hardest for me to physically imagine. What are the physical arrangements? What are the dimensions? Just to get what you would call a floor plan of a bark of that size was impossible. So anyway, I think I made it work, but I did find it difficult.
There is mention also of religion, and that, of course, comes back to the crap that we're dealing with today, you know, because all of these people seem to think this was a very religious country. And in your research and in the book, it doesn't seem too much that way. I mean, it's different than what it is now, but
remember, you know, in terms of, to invent a novel is one thing, to invent an entire country or the universe is something more complicated. And the role of religion in the United States at that period I certainly touch on. But there's certainly a lot more to be said about it than what's in my book. I mean, one of the things that the Tocqueville was always sort of, I think, shocked by is that having come from a society that was very, you know, Catholic and very sort of doctrinaire, that he found that, you know, that Americans really didn't care sort of, they had no, at that time, very few doctrinal matters. They didn't care, as long as they went to a church, they weren't going to squabble with each other too much.
Why did you choose to have Larrett Parrott spend a little bit of time in Australia?
Somebody said to me, you know, you could have written this book and not had that at all. Well, I could have. I guess I just wanted to. I guess your heart does sort of lead you in certain directions that you're faced with you now asking me this. I can't quite justify. I mean, I think I used it. I hope I used it very well to do all sorts of things about his life and the chances he might have to be an artist and why he'd, you know, how he grew, the complications of his life, pain of a life containing many, many lives. So all of those things, I think I used Australia well, but when you ask me why did I do that, I just get shifty and sort of a little embarrassed, because I guess it's there, you know, it's in me, and so I did that.
They also drink quite a bit of wine and alcohol in the course of the book, and I kept thinking, as our snobbish Olivier de Gaumont sips his wine, I kept thinking, would we consider the wine he drank swill, or would we consider it good tasting? And I don't know.
I think Olivier knew what he was drinking. When they arrive in Philadelphia and they find this French guy, Duponceau, who has a cellar, I think he's got good wine. There's been some work on Thomas Jefferson's cellar, for instance, and what wines he had and so on. And it seems that the wine he had at the end of his life anyway, when he was poorer, was not actually of the greatest quality. Probably what he had earlier was probably quite, he seems to know what he was drinking. But there was a lot of, people like to drink sweet wines, and the general taste for wine, I think, in the population was not terribly sophisticated.
You make a comment in an interview, an informed electorate would be a beautiful thing to see, talking about America. And, you know, the foreshadowing of Sarah Palin. But, of course, Sarah Palin is only one in a long line that includes, you know, William Jennings Bryan, Huey Long, George Wallace. Mm. I mean, this has been going on in America for a long time.
Who was I reading? Chris Hedges, writing about the vocabulary used by presidents in their speeches. And, you know, I don't know whether he was talking about Lincoln. I can't remember the examples that he chose. But, you know, let's say, you know, it starts with someone sort of talking, you know, and a vocabulary suitable sort of for 10th grade. And then it goes down and down and down and down. Obama's given some sort of blip. I think the really terrible thing that's happened, no, not only in this country, it's just that the influence of this country on politically and in terms of entertainment is so huge, is that, you know, of course, news has become entertainment. If a democracy needs information to flourish, the well we drink from is poisoned. We can't help but, in that aspect, be stupid. And the sort of great entertainments that the World Wrestling Federation and Jerry Springer or whatever it is, that seem like, you know, that the entertainment is some sort of psychological release for the cruelties that the working class suffers. And all the pain and rage can sort of be acted out in different ways. We are not getting any information. We've accepted that we're not going to read novels. We've sort of accepted it's not really important to read and to think. Firstly, the totally radical notion of the United States, the incredibly possibilities of democracy, how recent that was. Think about how literacy has arrived so very recently. And look how we're just letting it just go away. The education system is garbage. Fewer and fewer people can read. And now people are saying, well, if you want boys to read, you know, you've got to have a story that's got fewer, simpler words and at least one explosion in it and all this sort of thing. So there's a sort of a thing abroad that we should teach, encourage our children to read by feeding them crap. We're going to have get you to have healthy food by eating, going to McDonald's. So I think we're in a really bad way. And it's not just the United States either. I think it's life-threatening.
Australia gave us Peter Carey. It gave us Cate Blanchett. It gave us Hugh Jackman. It also gave us Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah. Our boy. Our boy, yes, absolutely. Talk about the well being poisoned and the incredible damage that is done to the political body by Fox. It's just unbelievable.
That's even more than that. Murdoch took the idea of tabloidization in England, and that was almost like a dry run for what he did in America.
Yeah.
Were you aware of Murdoch? I mean, at what point did you become aware of Murdoch?
I think I went to the same school. We knew about Rupert Murdoch, but see, his father was Sir Keith Murdoch, who was a newspaper proprietor. And I can't remember the story very well indeed, but I do think that Murdoch's father did not leave him everything or didn't leave him quite the empire that he expected to have. And he fought to have the empire. But as an Australian, you don't expect, an Australian of that time, you don't expect an Australian to be a world player in any sense at all. We didn't have those people, really. So Rupert Murdoch has sort of crept up on us, like he's crept up on the rest of everybody else.
I think he's become the most powerful man in this country because he controls Fox. Fox seems to control the Republican Party and on a more subconscious level seems to control or at least unduly influence the narrative that we see in the mainstream news.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it was very clear during the election that Murdoch was prepared to back Obama and that Obama wouldn't play, which was really wonderful. But it, and thank God he didn't do that of all the temptations and corruptions that are awaiting us. Anyway.
Peter Carey, now you've finished this book. You finished it a while ago. You've had a chance to begin. Are you working on another novel?
What else am I going to do?
Can you give any hints of where your research is taking you?
Part of it said she lives in London now. She's in her 40s. It will involve finally a relationship between her and an Englishman in Germany in 1861. She works at a museum like the Victoria and Albert. For 15 years, she has had an intimate, really important relationship with a man who also works at the Victoria and it's not the Victoria and Albert, but let's just say it's the Victoria and Albert. And it's been totally secret. And then he dies. And there isn't, she thinks, a single soul on earth who knows. She has to go to work straight after the funeral, straight after the death. That character is full of grief and there is one person she discovers at the museum who knows, who gives her this particular project to take her mind off the horror and puts her in an annex building so she will not be disgracing herself. And the project will be the restoration of an automaton. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous silver swan that moves and eats fish. And so the swan and the notion of an automaton, of course, deals with the notion of what life is and what is, you know, it goes back to Descartes and who believed that animals had no souls and were completely machines and so on. So there's a lot in it, and it's fun to do, and it's really nice to immerse myself in another world.
You've been listening to an interview with Peter Carey. whose latest novel is Parrot and Olivier in America. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.